Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Dr. George Mobus, a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and the author of the blog Question Everything. In the conversation today, we talk about systems thinking in theory, permaculture in the face of collapse, human wisdom, and how together all of that can have a lasting positive impact. Dr. Mobus was brought to my attention by a listener around the time of the release of the episode with Nicole Foss, and I found his work to be a nice complement to that conversation. If you're not familiar with Ms. Foss, I recommend you listen to that interview in addition to this one, but you don't have to listen to hers first. Of course, you'll find a link to that in the show notes. Before we begin, this show is listener-supported, and I need your help to keep it going and continue to expand on what it is that I'm able to do. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and become a one-time or recurring monthly contributor. Now then, on to Dr. George Mobus. I'll join you afterwards with a couple of notes and a list of quick updates. Then, George, as we get this conversation started, could you give the listeners a bit of your biography and background and how you came to the work that you're doing?
Sure. If I had to put a label on myself, I guess I would be a systems scientist. Technically, I have a PhD in computer science, but I was able to get that PhD in computer science only because I'd already studied a great deal of systems science. And computer science is really just a subset of that larger field. I teach at the University of Washington, Tacoma, at the Institute of Technology, and mostly do teach computer science, though I teach a couple of systems-based courses, particularly in the summer. My interests have been very, very wide-ranging. I actually have a degree in biology and a master's in business administration, of all things. And I did work in industry for many, many years before getting my PhD. I actually ran a company in Southern California that designed and manufactured what are called embedded systems controllers. So I have a fairly broad background and have sampled a number of different careers. And always the system science has always been sort of the common theme. And what I'm doing now with that is actually two things. One is studying how system science can inform and help us understand the world that we're facing, particularly the crisis situations that are coming on seemingly very strong of late. So that's one area, and that's the permaculture relation. And then the other is actually studying natural intelligence, and not just intelligence, but also wisdom. And I've done a lot of work in computer simulations that allow the emulation of natural intelligence. And right now we're working with robots that are autonomous agents. I have several graduate students working on that. And they're related, believe it or not. The way the brain works is very much related to the way the world works, not just through psychology and social psychology, but there's a deep correspondence between, you know, how society organizes itself and how the brain is organized. I don't want to go too much more deeply into that, but that does give you an idea of sort of the breadth of what I'm doing now.
I spent a lot of time, my first degree was in computer science, so I spent a lot of time in discrete mathematics and systems theory classes and things like that. But when you talk about systems science, for people who are involved in permaculture, that would be similar to the work of like Howard T. Odom when he was doing ecosystem ecology and his work on general systems theory, or perhaps Donella Meadows and her work, I believe it was at MIT, to generalize and simplify some of the ideas of system thinking?
Yes, exactly. In fact, my first exposure was through Howard Odom's work when I was a biology major. Then later, the limits to growth study and a variety of other things. There have been, it seemed like everywhere I went and everywhere I looked, I was seeing hints of systems this and systems that. And so I just started digging into it rather deeply. my master's business administration, my thesis was based on general systems theory and model-based information systems. So it's a sort of an umbrella, if you will, that encompasses really all sciences. There's a systems science of some kind in biology, ecology with Odom's work, and so forth. So it is probably the most general way of looking at the world and the best way to look at various aspects and see similarities, see what the differences are, but also see the deep similarities. So yes, Odom, Meadows, all those folks.
So if I'm following this, then you find that system science and systems theory provide a framework to compare different systems within?
Yes. I and a co-author, Mike Calton, and I, we're working on a textbook. We've got the book pretty much done, except for now we're incorporating reviewer comments. But the textbook really looks at the whole broad area. For example, complexity science, network theory, dynamics, evolution theory, on and on and on. All the aspects that collectively contribute to our understanding of systemness. And we expect that to be published by Springer, probably, I hope, will be available next fall for the academic year. But it attempts to find that framework whereby we can actually talk to one another. That is, the various sciences, people in the various sciences, they have their own vocabularies, but when it comes to systems, they can talk to one another about the system. I call it systemness. It's not a word, but maybe it will be one day, of the things that they're looking at specifically.
I'll be interested in your textbook when that comes out, because next semester will be my last semester as a graduate student, and if I remember right, I'm going to be taking ecosystem ecology, so that will be something I'll have to look for.
We're hoping the Appendix A will be the system science approach to sustainability, and Appendix B, as planned right now, and I hope we'll get it in the first edition, will be permaculture as an example of the application of system science to practical living.
Now I think that I definitely have to make sure that I get a copy of your textbook, whether I need it for my class or not.
Well, I can send you a copy of that appendix when it gets done.
I would very much appreciate that. Thinking about frameworks is interesting to me in this exact moment as we're having this conversation, because I'm one of the courses that I'm taking currently as we have this conversation is about ecological issues, and it all revolves around how do we communicate well both the science of things as well as the impacts that humanity has on our environment in a way that is approachable. And that's one of the things that I like about permaculture as a system, is that if I go and I sit in a room with a bunch of other people who have this training or this knowledge, we have a common dialogue and a way to speak with one another that kind of cuts through a lot of the socio-political baggage or that can come with some backgrounds and the places that we find ourselves in.
I'm very interested in the way in which I've talked to now many people, at least in this region, permaculture. And my wife actually did a tour of a, I've forgotten the name of it now, something Waters in Australia.
Was that Crystal Waters?
Crystal Waters near Melbourne. And the thing we note is the way in which people who had very different kinds of ideas originally, like I came at it from organic gardening, but very soon realized that you can't just talk about organic gardening. You have to talk about and understand principles that pertain to an entire settlement and a local region, which is how does the ecology surrounding you interface with what you're trying to do in sustaining a living situation? And people very quickly start to come to some sort of common language for expressing these. And it always revolves around the fact that this component affects this component, which affects that component, and they all affect one another one way or another. And very quickly, people are beginning to see how siting a home, for example, how getting catchments, water catchments situated and so forth, all affect one another, which I find pretty amazing.
As I continue to walk down this road of permaculture and environmental education and all these different pieces, I'm still amazed at the discoveries that are made as we understand how little we know about all those connections that are in the world. But then as they begin to open up the almost epiphanies that occur through that process, and understanding then A leads to B leads to C in a very realistic and practical way, I'd like to take that idea of all those connections and expand on it and talk about what led me to want to interview you about the world as you see it and where things are going.
Okay.
Regarding collapse and your vision of how relocalizing and permaculture can play a big role in our resilience regarding collapse.
Sure.
But with your very varied background and having come to some of this through organic gardening, how exactly was it that you discovered permaculture? And have you taken a permaculture design course? And if you have, what was that experience like with your background?
Answering the last part first, I have not taken a design course, but I know several people in this region who have academies, if you will, and who give them, and I've discussed various aspects of it. I've read David Holmgren's book on permaculture, and actually I've done just about everything that's in there. Throughout most of my life, I was always interested in tinkering and building things. And I said I did organic gardening. I actually, it was fairly extensive. But at one time or another, I've actually done just about everything, including site planning, things of that nature. So I didn't feel that I necessarily needed to take a permaculture. As to how I discovered it, I don't know. I'm always scanning the horizon for new things, and I ran across this term permaculture. And as you know, today with the Wikipedia and Google, it's pretty easy to locate information very quickly. I probably, like most people, when they first hear the term, thought, oh my gosh, this is yet another sort of hippie type of back to the land approach. But as I discovered more and more about the background and how these guys had actually derived a lot of these ideas from Howard Odum, I dug deeper, and suddenly a light went off, and I said, gee, man, Christmas is just system science applied to a holistic living approach. And so ever since that time, I've been pretty much an advocate. One of the courses I teach here is part of the freshman core. It's about system science, but the example that I use is permaculture. That's where this appendix that I was telling you about is going to come from. And the students really respond to this because they too, you know, go at it like, well, I've got my iPhone and all my technology. What do I need to know about that for? And then we go through looking at the future of food production. And I use, I don't know if you're familiar with Pimentel, David Pimentel, work on the future, but he's pretty pessimistic about large-scale farming providing any kind of stable food supply. And so the students and I go through looking at what are the problems from a systemic standpoint of providing food. When you go to the supermarket and you walk down the aisle and you see all this stuff, where does it come from? Let's take a look. What are the inputs to the system? Where are those inputs going to come from in the future? What's happening to them now, particularly things like energy, oil, and natural gas? And by the time we finish that, they're listening to the idea that setting up a permaculture community is probably a pretty good idea. I had two students last year came back 2 quarters later and asked me if I knew of anybody who was doing that, and I pointed them in that direction. So little by little, I think they're aware of the problems that society faces, and nobody is really providing them with pointers to solutions. And so when they hear about something that is, it isn't what they expected their lives to be. They're not going to be out, with the latest, greatest gadgets, texting their friends, whatever the case may be. They're going to actually be doing work, but not just surviving, but actually, potentially anyway, thriving. They look like they're responding to it.
One of the questions that I've wondered, because of the direction that I've come to permaculture from, is that in the designer's manual and in Holmgren's writing, there seems to be an anti-academia thread in the permaculture literature and the community.
Mm-hmm.
Before I continue with the rest of that question, would you say that that's fair from your exposure?
Well, I think his name escapes me. Not Holmgren, but...
Bill Mollison?
Yeah, Mollison. I think that's true of Mollison's work. I've read a number of his things, and I did get that sense. I didn't get the sense from Holmgren's Principles and Pathways that he was necessarily anti-academia, but I suspect that both of them are into, I won't say even anti-technology, but at least very cool on technology, which is kind of interesting for guys like you and I who sort of got our education in technology areas. But from what I understand, Holmgren is becoming more and more strident in his views on whether or not permaculture is actually going to be the salvation of mankind, or it's simply going to provide lifeboat support for those who are smart enough to get into it now.
I interviewed David last year, and at that time, he still seemed fairly hopeful if enough people would convert to this.
Mm-hmm.
From his most recent writing, that's there's been quite a lot of hubbub about. I would agree with your assessment that it does seem that permaculture is not going to necessarily provide that hopeful way forward from his perspective.
There are actually quite a large number of us who've been blogging for several years, going back 4 or 5 years, starting out trying to call attention to the societal problems that we're facing, as well as global warming and climate change and all of its implications. And basically the intent of saying, look, folks, there's a different way to do things, and it's not going to be what you had expected, this bright, shining future of accumulating more and more stuff, but it is, and it will involve you physically working to support yourself, but it's a sustainable future. And as we've gone along, things like the new revelations about the, you might call the sustainability of alternative energy, things like solar PV and wind energy and things like that. I did spend some time with Charles Hall at SUNY State College, New York State College at Environmental Sciences and Forestry in Syracuse, New York. And we studied energy systems from the perspective of what's called energy return on energy investment. And he had for years been collecting data on particularly the oil industry. And as you probably know, the oil now that we're getting is mostly coming, or starting to be mostly coming, from non-traditional sources such as the fracking, Barnett shale fracking, and tar sands in Canada. These are extremely energy-intensive extraction methods. Deep water platforms are extremely energy-intensive, and the result is the net energy that comes out of that, that goes to society to do, you know, drive our cars and light our homes and all this kind of stuff, that net energy is actually starting to decline. It has been declining since the 1970s on a per capita basis, partly because it's stagnant. The net energy flow is stagnant, but population has continued to increase. So today we're looking at economic problems throughout the world that are largely due to a decline in net energy available per capita to do the work, the economic work that produces this stuff. So these people who have been blogging about this for a number of years, myself included, are all now gradually coming to the conclusion that, you know what? A, this is an unstoppable train. The momentum toward more global warming, toward more depletion of resources, which includes water and soil and so forth, is at this point literally unstoppable. And all one has to do is look at China to see that, see it starkly. So that aspect. And the other aspect is people are not listening. They just, the vast majority of people are maintaining that, oh yes, there are these problems, but somehow we'll figure it out and we will restore a growth economy and everybody will be happy thereafter. And when you look at that, you say, okay, you've got this unstoppable train and you've got nobody at the wheel and nobody interested in putting on the brakes, except for a very small number, very small percentage of people who can see it. And those people are the ones who are going to do something about it. And what are they going to do? They're going to set up a permaculture community. One of the things that I've been really, really spending a lot of time on lately is the nature of evolution. We're talking about biological evolution. And I mentioned earlier the workings of the brain. And what occurs to me is that the thing that's lacking in the vast majority of human beings is sufficient capacity for wisdom. The brain is, you know, evolved to deal with a certain kind of environment in Africa and small tribe situations and so forth. And we're fundamentally, physically anyway, the same people that we were back then. But one thing that didn't develop is when we discovered writing and agriculture and technology and all this kind of stuff, we didn't evolve the sufficient wisdom to go along with that. In other words, making choices based on understanding the consequences or potential consequences in the future of actions today. And so we basically go for the short-term profit and forget about the long-term. And that's just us as a species. However, I think, my opinion, I'm not trying to cater to your audience, but my thought is that people who actually have a more natural systems vision of things and who recognize permaculture as being a way of organizing your community, that they are more likely to survive any potential collapse that might be coming down the pike, and also be the ones who survive into the future, providing a, what I have to say, is a better genetic basis for any future populations of humans that might come about. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of an evolutionary bottleneck. Have you heard that term?
Yes, I've encountered the idea of the evolutionary bottleneck, and I've also read several books about evolutionary psychology.
Uh-huh.
Which is something I might have a question for you here in a moment, but please continue.
The idea of a bottleneck, and it has happened to humans before. And when they were emerging in Africa, the population may have been driven down to as few as 10,000 individuals. It was a climate crisis that caused this, but afterwards they emerged as being very, very adaptive and went on to get out of Africa and to colonize the rest of the world. I suspect that's what we're looking at in the future, in the not too distant future, that if we do have collapse on a global scale, that it will reduce the population substantially. And what I'm hoping and what I'm betting on, if you will, is that people who have thought ahead and seen this potential have, in fact, organized themselves in these permaculture communities. Those are the ones who have the highest likelihood of surviving that bottleneck and then after conditions settle down, being the ones who seed future populations and future evolution. So it's hopeful for humanity in a sense, but we've got to go through some pain to get there.
That paints a picture that is hopeful for humanity as a whole, but pessimistic for us as individuals. What is it, do you think, about permaculture that people connect with to begin taking these long-term perspectives and to start investing in the now, knowing that it might not pay off for generations? Is there something about the mindset of people who come to this? Is it the permaculture training opens them up to it? Or is there something else that you would say is part of that?
Well, I was mentioning this capacity for wisdom earlier, and in my investigations, I found that there is a particular brain region, and it's called the Brodmann Area 10 in the prefrontal cortex. It's the patch of specialized neocortex that lies right behind the eyebrows. It is the newest add-on, if you will, to brains in mammals and primates in particular, and in humans, it literally doubled in size over the last 200,000, well, sometime around about 200,000 years ago. It is recognized as being sort of the seat of a lot of our very much higher cognitive capacities and is probably also related to the development of language and what we call consciousness, you know, the human version of consciousness. Oh, and then very recently, they've discovered sort of a smaller patch within that patch that is probably less than about 100,000 years ago developed. And the implication for these brain regions is a new and more elaborate kind of intuitive thinking. Our intuitions have largely, for most of our history or evolution, been guided by emotional content, whereas this little patch of tissue in the prefrontal cortex has access to all kinds of tacit memories. It's not what you would call rational processing per se, where we think of rational processing as being like logic or mathematical or, you know, going through the decision tree process. This is more holistic, and it's based on the tacit knowledge that one has to work with. You can think of this tacit knowledge as being like a database that you've built up over a lifetime. And so the combination of this specialized brain region and the accumulation of sufficient knowledge gives rise to that which we recognize and call wisdom. And typically, it's seen in older people. However, the processing capacity for it is there from a very early age. My thesis is that there are some people that, just like every other human trait, there's variation in the population with this, and that there are some people who have more developed, and this is a genetic basis, have a more developed Brodmann Area 10, if you will, that allows them to make connections more readily and to be able to see systems thinking much more readily. Not see systems thinking, but see systems or do systems thinking much more readily. And so when they do get exposed to something like permaculture, it is easier for them to make a connection. Now, on top of that, we did come from a time not all that long ago when we were absolutely connected to the land, to the ecology that we lived in. And we evolved to be connected. So consequently, you put those two things together, this natural underlying connection that we all have with the natural environment and the development of this capacity for wisdom. And I think that could go a long way to explain why certain people can latch on to permaculture with just exposure to it, not even a whole lot of necessarily getting educated in it, but just simply seeing parts and pieces of it and going, of course, that makes sense.
That was my wife's reaction to me when she read David Holmgren's Principles and Pathways and Toby Hemingway's Gaia's Garden. She just read them and she's like, and gave them back to me. Why do you need to know so much about this to make it work? It's a very interesting thesis to have. And now the geek side of my brain is firing, going, ooh, I want to go read more about this and find articles and see what I can read.
I have some working papers. I haven't quite yet decided whether or not I'm going to try to publish some of this stuff. I do have some working papers that are available through my blog site on, I call it sapience, the basis of humans being different from the other primates and even our progenitors. We've agreed on this term sapience, which comes from, you know, the Latin for wisdom. I don't think we as a species are particularly sapient. We're primordial sapient, if you will. And that's the crux of the problem. If we were more sapient, we wouldn't be in these messes. And so I've written quite a bit about it, starting from the basic psychology that's already been done. People have been working on measuring wisdom, much like they measure intelligence and at least characterizing it. And then I move on to the brain science behind it, and then finally look at the evolutionary implications, both where did sapience come from evolutionarily, and then where might it possibly go, which is kind of what I outlined here.
So would it be fair to say, with your idea of human beings currently having primordial sapience, that in a way we are capable of sapience, but it's something that we need to develop in order to have a greater understanding of our personal wisdom or a greater development of wisdom?
Well, this was a tough one, because if you're familiar with the literature on intelligence, we know that intelligence is, and I'm talking now about general intelligence, as a psychologist would talk about it, is very much based in genetic endowment. However, there's, like every other trait, there's adaptive range. And so if a child with a what would be considered an average level of intelligence were to be brought up in a information-rich environment in which they were encouraged to learn things and so forth, that their intelligence would actually be expanded above what it would be if they were just in a sort of an ordinary average environment. And the same is true. You could get someone whose genetic endowment should allow them to have superior intelligence, who, by chance, live in an environment that is very information poor and where there's no motivation to learn and so forth. And what you end up with is somebody who is stunted. There are the rare cases where somebody has the endowment and in spite of their environment, they manage to move forward. And I would hazard a guess, or even hypothesize, if you will, that those people are ones who have a higher level of sapience as well. And that's what drives them to develop their own intelligence more broadly. So anyway, getting back to sapience itself, the brain basis is genetic. And then the degree to which whatever level you get of that capability, from a genetic standpoint, could it be boosted by appropriate exposure to environments that are sensitive to wisdom issues? Possibly. As our environment, the environment that most of us live in, done quite the opposite, stunted what would normally be much higher level of sapience. I suspect that's true. We're spoiled at this point. We've grown up in a spoiled society. We've become materialists to a huge extent. And I suspect that native sapience, whatever genetic endowment you got, has been stunted. So whether or not that can be changed, and certainly whether or not it can be changed in a time frame necessary for the vast majority of people to be able to see what's going on and make better choices as a result, I have serious doubts about that. There's work that says something like 38% of a population has to come to congruence on an opinion, and if only 38%, then there's enough impetus to actually change the social structure in that direction. My guess is that something like 2% of the population is of sufficient sapience to be able to push these kinds of agendas like permaculture. And that's just too small a number, too. There's not enough there.
With what you were saying about exposure for intelligence and information-rich environments, there's an article that I'll try to track down to include in the show notes. But it was about a study that followed children, I believe in California, and I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, who were born addicted to recreational drugs. I believe it was largely crack cocaine and cocaine in the 80s. And they followed them through the present, and they finally released some of the research from that. And they showed that overwhelmingly, children were at the most risk to be stunted because of poverty, not their exposure to drugs in the womb. With intelligence, it was something of, if I remember right, around 9 points that these children scored lower than their other peers who were not in poverty, even with the exposure to those drugs. And that makes me think about a lot of the research and reading from some of the environmental education theorists, such as David Orr or David Sobel. And I'm wondering if exposure to the natural world and being in a less controlled environment where there are so many systems interacting all at once in front of us would be a realm in which we could go to increase this personal wisdom.
I think there might be a great deal of wisdom in that, because if you look at indigenous peoples today and you look at the way the children are raised, they, from a very early age, they're quite capable of making very intelligent and wise decisions about how they interact with their world, which is every bit as complex. I mean, who knows the names of thousands of species of potential food animals and plants? I mean, this is just, their world is extremely complex. But the way they're exposed to it leads one to believe, this is from Jared Diamond's observations, leads one to believe that, yes, that early exposure to natural environments and the way their parents raised them, that they're recognizing more of their potential than typical Western developed societies, where the most complex thing somebody has to figure out how to do is text their friends.
I look around the space that I'm in right now and how few decisions I have to make to live my life within this place relative to if I were outside right now, where it's, well, thankfully above freezing for the first time in a long time as we talk, but to all the different decisions and interactions that I would have in an uncontrolled, natural, if you will, environment compared to the human-built environment.
Well, we spent many thousands of years building a human-built environment so that we would simplify our lives.
And there's an idea that I was recently exposed to, is that the problems of the world are not the world's problems, but they're problems that have been made by humanity.
Right. Yeah.
We've roamed far and wide over this conversation, and I don't know that we spent as much time on your view of collapse and where we could be going, but I feel that we did cover many of the ideas of what we need to do to build the lifeboats, and hopefully those can turn into life cruise ships that we can bring a lot of people with us on, or perhaps even bring about, hopefully, from my perspective, a societal change. But with the time that we have left, is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
Yeah, well, we did go rather broadly. So the whole thing about collapse is, I do not make predictions about what's going to happen. I'm a theorist, actually, and a lot of people might, you know, kind of, I don't want to say scoff at it, but think, well, what can a theorist tell us? And they're probably right, but the theories that I work with are these very sort of large-scale theories. So like the limits of oil, for example, I built models, computer models, that are based on just pure physics. I mean, they have nothing to do with finances or anything else, but just pure physics and the role of humans exploiting everything they could get their hands on for near-term profit. In other words, they're going to get the oil out of the ground as quickly as they possibly can to use it. And those kinds of models demonstrate beyond any doubt that the nature of the downside. So if you're familiar with Hubbard's model of peak oil, it basically looks like a normal curve. It comes to a peak and then slides down the other side symmetrically with the upside. My models demonstrate that once we start going down, we go down rapidly. And if that turns out to be the case, then collapse is going to come very rapidly, and that's what leads me to this bottleneck concept. I would just say that the earliest that anybody can get off of fossil fuel energy, not just to be saving the planet because we're already too late in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide we put into the air, but to get off of it to learn how to live more naturally on the land is probably the most important thing that anybody could be thinking about right now.
And as we've discussed throughout this conversation, you see permaculture as one of those ways forward.
I do. It may take some more development, may take a little broadening of ideas. Like, for example, I've been working on the interfaces. You know, most of the permaculture communities that I am familiar with are still, I think, a little heavily dependent upon their interfaces with the rest of society. And they're going to have to think more broadly. I mentioned David Pimentel's work. So I calculate from his work that you need, if you're not going to be dependent on an external environment, in other words, you're just the local environment that you interact with directly, you're going to need about 4 hectares per individual of mixed use. In other words, this is going to be highlands with rocks and trees and a forestry area, pastures, water catchments. 4 hectares is a lot, and a lot more than most permaculture units are considering right now. But that's what it's going to take to be able to support people. And so if you multiply 4 hectares by however many people, let's say 50 people in the community, you're talking about a lot of land. But from the standpoint of the flow of energy and the flow of materials through the permaculture system, that's pretty much what it's going to take, those fluxes.
And I know much of the discussion, and I've been a part of it, is about how much can we do with how little? And a lot of that has been around the concept of just growing enough food for those people, not looking at all the additional resources that would be required for sustainable and then regenerative communities.
I would add this, actually, this isn't something that came up, but it's not just a matter of surviving, and you don't want to target subsistence living. We're human beings. We have hopes and dreams and philosophical thoughts. We want to be self-actualizing creatures. And if you design something that will only allow you to live in subsistence, you're not going to have those happy moments. So whatever the system is, however it's arranged and designed, it has to be for the ultimate goal of providing people with the ability to grow themselves and find what they want to do. You're going to have room for art, music, literature, all those kinds of things. Otherwise, what's the point? What's the point?
You've raised many incredible questions for me as a permaculture practitioner and teacher and just someone who's really interested in the idea of building a better world for everyone and everything. I really thank you for this time that you spent with me, George. So thank you for joining me on the show.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
And that was Dr. George Mopus. At one point in our conversation, I referenced an article about the impact of poverty on children. I was able to find that article and have included a link to that in the show notes. There you'll also find a link to George's blog, Question Everything, his page at the University of Washington, as well as to the work by Dave Pimentel and Charles Hall. There isn't a lot of commentary for me on this episode, as George covered the spread of what we were talking about fairly well, and his understanding of permaculture connects his ideas to our work as permaculture practitioners, and provides a way forward through what the future holds. The picture is bleaker than I personally see ahead of us, but the hope in all of this is that by taking action, we can make a difference. We have a model and a framework, permaculture, a way to do that work, our strategies and techniques. Now all we need to do is apply permaculture to our lives and what it is we're doing, and make the changes that we want and are necessary for the road we find ourselves on. If you have thoughts or questions stemming from this episode, please contact me. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or give me a phone call, 717-827-6266. I put those contact methods out there so that I can help you along your path so that we can create a better world together. And I would like you to reach out to me if you think it would make a difference in your life and the work that you're doing. Real quick then, that handful of short updates, and we'll bring this episode to a close. There are still spaces available in the open enrollment permaculture design course. Contact me if you would like to receive a copy of the syllabus and Section 1, Unit 1, to see if this course is for you. If you've already heard about the program and would like to register, the address to do so is www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/PDC-tuition. And as a reminder, the Traveling Permaculture Library Project is still going on. I'm going to be mailing out 2 more books as part of this program tomorrow, and you can find out more information at www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/library. And last of these, I am proceeding with taking sponsors for the show. If you'd like to receive information about that program, how it works, and the costs, please contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call 717-827-6266. That's it for our time together today. I'll join you again for another episode soon. Until then, spend some time each day building a better world by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.